Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Several canonical laws being violated today, just one guest, and an unusually sustained focus on the right wing of the political spectrum. We'll hear from Sam Tannenhaus about his new book, Buckley, The Life and Revolution That Changed America, just out from Random House. Frequent listeners may know that I had a brief sojourn on the right in late high school and early college, and the influence of William F. Bill Buckley on my 18-year-old mind was an important reason for it. Buckley made his debut as a conservative polemicist straight out of college with his book God and Man at Yale, published in 1951. He was the Christopher Rufo of his time, accusing his alma mater of being too liberal and too atheist, and demanding a purge of the professoriate. Around the same time, he did some work for the CIA, supervised by Howard Hunt, later a major player in the Watergate scandal, a time when the agency was dominated by Cold War liberals of the sort that also hired Gloria Steinem. In 1955, soon after leaving the CIA, he founded National Review, and there followed a lifetime of quickie books, a TV show, and innumerable public appearances. He died at the age of 82 in 2008. In his early days, the right was extremely marginal, but Buckley had a lot to do with making it less so. His patrician style gave conservative ideas a force and a charm that frothing lunatics of the right could never match. He was, as Tannenhaus put it, a performing ideologue and a very skilled one. His TV show, Firing Line, which ran from 1966 to 1999, featured conversations at a rather high intellectual level, and often with figures of the left, such as Saul Alinsky, Allen Ginsberg, and Noam Chomsky, though with plenty of representation from the right, too, like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. You could not imagine a similar program today. And given the cretinous nature of today's right, it's easy to get nostalgic for Buckley's sophistication. But under that cosmopolitan style, there is plenty of the darkness that has always permeated the right. Racism, most notably, but also bellicosity and a scorn for the lower orders. Buckley himself may be a fading memory today, but his influence lasts. Sam Tannenhaus is a former editor of the New York Times Book Review and author of a biography of Whittaker Chambers. Sam Tannenhaus. You've been working on this book for 25 years. How did it come to be, and how did your view of the subject evolve over time?
I got to know Bill Buckley, and if you met him, you know that's what everyone called him. I got to know him in 1990 when I started work on a biography of Whittaker Chambers, who was one of his heroes, and whose sponsor Buckley had been. That's one of the odd things about Buckley is he would be a patron to older figures, and Chambers was famous for his, or notorious for his role in the Alger Hiss perjury/spy case in the late 1940s, and then had become kind of a recluse, and Buckley had discovered Chambers, kind of given him a lifeline in his last years and become very close to him. And I knew if I was going to write a biography of Chambers, that Bill Buckley was a gatekeeper of sorts. And I was young then, in my early mid-30s. I hadn't written a big book. And he was just someone whose help I really wanted. He was extremely generous. I hadn't done much of anything. I was not an ideological conservative. He assumed I subscribed to National Review, which I did not. And I just wanted to write about Chambers. But Buckley just helped. He helped in every conceivable way. He made phone calls and opened doors and found grant money, and also would check in with me to see how I was doing. And the more I got to know him, the more intrigued I became. And so when the Chambers book was published in 1997, to Buckley's satisfaction, he liked it, and so did Buckley's son Christopher, the novelist. We just talked about whether I might write the full-fledged biography, which made sense to all of us. And lo, these many years later, the book got written. But that's how I got to know him, through Whittaker Chambers.
What would have been Bill's 100th birthday is coming up in November. It makes me wonder, what is his relevance today? Does anyone younger than we are, I think we're about the same age, know or care about him?
I'll tell you, fewer and fewer do, Doug. I remember when I first was working on the book and I'd gotten a contract to go over to Vanity Fair magazine. And the editor was the famous Graydon Carter, and he'd liked the Chambers book, and that's why he brought me on to write articles for him. And another biography had just come out of Saul Bellow, one of my literary idols, but a very good biographer, James Atlas. Graydon, who is an admirer of Atlas, had him write for him a lot. And I discussed how the Bellow biography was getting some attention, but not really selling all that much as far as we could tell. And he said, well, is that going to be a problem for you? And I said, I don't think so. I don't know about sales, but it's far of interest for him. Because Buckley's so famous. This is 1998 or 1999, mind you. Graydon said, oh, really? He cocked his head in that way. He said, oh, really? I mean, he really, is he that famous? And he knocked on his window. He had this enormous office in the old Condé Nast building. And a very young guy came over. I mean, someone right out of the Ivy League, as all those assistants were, I'm guessing 24 years old. And Graydon Carter said to him, who's William F. Buckley? And this young guy said, a writer? With all these unstated question marks at the end. And Graydon smiled at me, and he was telling me, of course, that under a certain age, people didn't know who Buckley was. Well, that's 25 years ago. And since then, many more humans have trod the planet, and fewer of them know who Buckley is. There's been a kind of renewed interest in him because of all the changes in the Republican Party with the ascendancy of Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. So the question has arisen whether Buckley is responsible for that in some way he couldn't foresee or perhaps did, or whether his era and his style of conservatism has been supplanted and defeated by Trumpism. So in that sense, Buckley's name is circulating again. But I have found that familiarity with him, his famous television program, Firing Line, which went off the air again in 1999, it's been a lot of years. And if you're a media person, as he essentially was, the reputations fade pretty quickly.
A contradiction that would characterize his life, and more over time as he got more famous, was that he was part of the cultural elite, a kind of rebel from within, but he had to ally with the masses, and I should say white masses, politically, people he and many of his circle looked down on. They were not distinctive small-D Democrats. How should we think about that contradiction?
I know. You could say, and in some ways the book explores that contradiction, that on the one hand, Buckley and his colleagues, especially his elder mentors at National Review, they were highly sophisticated intellectuals. Many of them had been communists. They were ex-communists or ex-socialists. They're extremely well-read and learned. Some of them were multilingual. Buckley himself is multilingual. He knew Spanish and French as well as English. Spanish was his first language, actually. So they saw themselves as part of an elite. And Bill Buckley's hero, as you and some listeners will know, was the libertarian and social Darwinist writer Albert J. Nock, who'd been a big figure in the 1920s and 30s. And this was a very elite kind of H.L. Mencken disdain for the unwashed masses, as he used to call them. At the same time, Buckley, who was ever pragmatic and strategic, realized the only successes his movement, and he really was the leader of a movement, you know, from his really mid-20s, you know, from about 1950 on, Buckley knew they had to have a large mass following. And the figure who made them all see that was Joe McCarthy. So if you look closely at Buckley's relationship with Joe McCarthy, as I do in the book, and we talked a lot about him, McCarthy was the subject we probably talked about most, Buckley and I. It's interesting, I find myself saying these things to you because I can feel you're inside that world.
I was once. I'm no longer.
Yeah, that you get it in a way. So when I say those things, they come out much more naturally. And I can tell you, Joe McCarthy was probably the topic we discussed, the person we talked about most. It's probably Joe McCarthy and Reagan, whom Buckley had a complicated relationship with, and his great friend Henry Kissinger, became Buckley's best friend in his last years. Those are the people we talked about most. And McCarthy interested him because he was the first one to really galvanize a large part of the population with an attack on the elites themselves. People think of McCarthy as someone who harassed and intimidated poor people or, you know, low-ranking government workers, which he did. But really, his campaign was similar to the one we're seeing now in Trump's administration, which is to attack the elites at the top of the culture, as Buckley had done in his first book, God Man at Yale, and then as Buckley and his brother-in-law, Brett Bozell, did in their defense of Joe McCarthy, which is still the most ambitious defense of McCarthy, called McCarthy and His Enemies. And what's essential in that book, Doug, is the second half of the title, The Enemies. It was much more about the enemies than it was about McCarthy himself. And I think it's fair to say, if we look at a lot of the MAGA discourse, we'll call it, from J.D. Vance on down, it's really about the sins of liberal elites more than it is about advancing particular ideological programs. And that's why the alliances stay the same and the movement holds together, even when the policies will be radically different from minute to minute. They're united in their enmities, as I think of them, and as Buckley thought of them.
The alliance with McCarthy is interesting because, you know, the early National Review made a point to separate itself from the cranks who had populated the right-wing movement at the time. Some of that still populate a lot of it. But McCarthy was really, in many ways, one of those cranks himself. He was an ignoramus, a liar, a demagogue. So, you know, you run into this contradiction between Buckley's own membership in the cultural elite and somebody like McCarthy, who I guess he needed, you know, for the popular mobilization. But, yeah, how did he adjust to the fact that McCarthy was such a disreputable character?
It's one of the oddest aspects of Buckley's life. Someone who was important to me in the writing of this book was an early Buckley protege turned apostate, in Buckley's term, the great Gary Wills, the historian and writer. Not to be confused with George Will, who was also a Buckley protege. But George Will didn't break away the way Gary Wills did. Gary really went pretty far left. He wrote a famous book about Nixon agonists, and many books on Catholicism. And he'd been kind of Buckley's tutor in the history and doctrine of Catholicism. And when Gary Wills read my book in galleys, I sent an advanced reader's copy. He's now 91. And he said, well, I can read 100 pages a day, which is quite remarkable. When Gary Wills reads 100 pages, he reads them. That is, he underlines, he marks them up, sends notes. And at the end of reading what is quite a long book, he said, I have just drawn up a list of the unsavory characters Bill Buckley was associated with, and it filled half a page. You probably noticed, some readers have, Donald Trump is mentioned only once in the book, in a very long book, and that's because he and Bill Buckley were both character witnesses for Roy Cohn. And
yeah,
speak of unsavory characters. And of course, Buckley was loyal to Cohn because Cohn was loyal to Joe McCarthy. Cohn had worked for Joe McCarthy. And Buckley was so close to McCarthy that people thought he was on the payroll, which he was not. He volunteered his services. But it shows you how I think there was almost a kind of attraction to figures like that. Another one, E. Howard Hunt, the Watergate felon. He was. Yeah, that was a little different. It's true. But you know what? And Buckley worked for less than a year, but they became very close in Mexico City right around the time Buckley's first book was being published. What was interesting about that, too, though, Doug, is that years later, when it was apparent to most people who knew Hunt that he'd really become a kind of lowlife, he's on these pulpy novels and doing all these unspeakable deeds in the White House as one of the plumbers, the Watergate plumbers, Buckley still saw Hunt, even at this point, as this kind of ethically pure, noble figure. And no one else could understand it. And, of course, the most striking example of all was the convicted murderer whose case Buckley took up, Edgar Smith. And some readers have been surprised that I have so much on Edgar Smith in the book. Buckley's relationship with him weaves through the 1970s. Well, the reason I did that was because Buckley talked about Edgar Smith a lot. He was really invested in him.
Once he liked someone, he was very loyal, right? He stuck with them.
Very loyal. Yeah, I think it was Gary Wills who said he was too trusting of people he liked. Some of the critics of my book have said, well, he was too trusting of me, you know, he let me inside the gate. He was very forgiving. It's part of his Catholicism. Very charitable, very forgiving. And friendship was so important to him. Friendship trumped everything else, including politics.
I'm speaking with Sam Tannenhaus, author of Buckley, The Life and Revolution That Changed America, just out from Random House. I want to talk about two angles in his background that a lot of people may not be fully aware of. One is the importance of Mexico, especially in his early life, and then the South. So let's start with Mexico. What was the influence of Mexico on him?
His father, W.F.B. Sr., William F. Buckley Sr., who's best thought of as a kind of a parallel to Joseph Kennedy, the patriarch of the great Irish Catholic clan, for whom he has enormous ambitions as progenitor. William F. Buckley Sr. was born in South Texas, 1881, but he made lost his first fortune in Mexico. He spoke fluent Spanish from childhood because he was from that area, Davao County, that was largely Hispanic. And if you were Catholic, as the Buckleys were, that's whom you saw, you know, every Sunday at Mass. And so he made his fortune. After he got a law degree at the University of Texas, Buckley Sr. went to Mexico City, started a law practice there, and then hit it big in the oil boom in Tampico, which some will remember from the film The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. If you see that movie made in 1948, it actually was filmed in Tampico. So Buckley Sr. made his career there and began to see himself as a kind of Catholic Mexican aristocrat. That's really the ideology the Buckleys grew up with. And Buckley Sr. married a young woman who was also Catholic, Swiss-German descent, Alois Steiner from New Orleans. So they were two deep Southerners, both Catholic, who grew up in caste societies, caste in the Isabel Wilkerson sense. And that's how Buckley was raised. When they built their estate in the northwest corner, as it's called, of Connecticut, near the Berkshires, Bill Buckley and his nine siblings in this very philoprogenitive Catholic family were raised as almost as if they were Spanish aristocrats, although really Mexican. My wife and I were recently at the old homestead, and it has this magnificent solarium and atrium in the house, in this old colonial New England house that was built in the Spanish style. That's how the Buckleys were raised. So Mexico was hugely important. Mexico had also had its revolution.
The Buckleys didn't like that, right?
They were on the other side. They were on the side of the dictators. And Buckley Sr.'s idol was Porfirio Diaz, whom nobody remembers today, but in his period was considered by Theodore Roosevelt, among others, the greatest statesman in the entire Western Hemisphere, because he had lifted Mexico from poverty into a kind of modern economy. That was the ambition. That was the ideal condition for a true reactionary of that era. That's why they hated Franklin Roosevelt so much, because he came in and blew everything up and said income had to be redistributed. But the Buckleys were raised to think if you just let rich business guys have their way, the world would be a better place, not unlike what we're seeing in this very moment.
Yeah, and then the South, a lot of family connections, but he was pretty soft in the region's racial politics. He seemed fine with Jim Crow. He was distressed by Brown v. Board of Education. Not fond of the idea of giving black people the vote, described white people as the advanced race. How deeply rooted was that in his thinking, and how much did those views change over time, if at all?
Well, that turned out, as I have a feeling you know, to be the big discovery I made in the research. When I went to the Buckley's second home, Bill Buckley and his nine siblings were raised, as I mentioned, in New England, in southern New England, Connecticut. But they wintered in South Carolina, not far from the notorious Strom Thurmond, who was a family friend, who had run on the segregationist Dixiecrat ticket in 1948. The Buckleys had a winter home there, a town called Camden, beautiful antebellum mansion. One of the discoveries I made was that the family, that is Buckley's parents, but also he and his siblings, were to one extent or another involved in the publication of a pro-segregationist newspaper, a weekly newspaper that was started at the same time as National Review. It was founded as part of the massive resistance to the Brown decision. A massive resistance was the phrase everyone used Those among your listeners who think Trump and company's assault on judicial decrees is unprecedented, look again at how the conservative South reacted to the Brown decision in 1954. They just swore to do everything they could to resist and overturn.
They hadn't really given up the fight.
No, they haven't. They never really gave it up. And Buckley, to some extent, was part of that. And finally, his eyes were opened, and I give him credit for that, because there were many of his generation who didn't come around, but he did. He met black people, more and more of them, got to know them. I suggest your listeners, since you can get Buckley's great television debate program, Firing Line, many of the episodes on YouTube, check out his interview with Muhammad Ali in 1968, I think it was. It's pretty great. The two of them debate the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X, with Muhammad Ali defending Elijah Muhammad and Buckley defending Malcolm for breaking away from it. It's pretty interesting.
Well, he kind of liked the Black Power revolutionaries, right?
He did. Well, he liked it. Listen, if you're a segregationist, separatism works. He liked apartheid in South Africa. He thought it was a system. It was, of course, modeled on Jim Crow, but it was more, what shall we say, more thoroughly worked out and engineered. Conservatives of the Buckley generation opposed all social engineering, except when it came to the American South. Then they were all in favor of sending people off to separate schools and making sure they couldn't intermarry and all these other things, couldn't vote.
Miscegenation really distressed him, right?
Yes, it was a concern for him. That's where the South came in. I'd had a suspicion, Doug, when I started working on this and digging into the material, that the states' rights argument was kind of invented later. It was really a miscegenation argument, and the Buckley documents confirmed that. There was a letter Buckley wrote when he was editing the Daily News at the newspaper, the alma mater you shared with him, and Buckley would not lend the paper support even to a mixer, a dance, with young women from Howard University mingling and young men from Howard mingling with white students at Yale.
You quote Henry Jaffa. Jaffa said the origin of American conservatism is the ideology of the Old South of the 1860s. It never changed. It sounds right, but it's really striking to see it expressed so baldly.
Well, what surprised me was that's not a quote I dug up somewhere. Harry Jaffa told me that himself.
Like 2010 or something, right?
Yeah, I went out to Claremont, and again, just a brief thumbnail, Jaffa was the first, and possibly, with the exception maybe of Alan Bloom, the most talented disciple of Leo Strauss, the philosopher. And so Jaffa was on the right. He wrote the most famous words Barry Goldwater ever spoke at the 1964 convention about moderation and extremism. They're still the most remembered words in Goldwater's long life. Harry Jaffa wrote them. He was on the right. But the idea that you would actually deny black people, say, the right to vote, that it was in the Constitution, the 15th Amendment, was just appalling to him. And he told me this, and he was a friend of Buckley's. He told me this in a very direct way. And about a dozen years ago, maybe a little more, I wrote a story for the New Republic magazine, which I used to write for a lot, about the Republican Party and its relationship with race. And many on the right, National Review and such, Buckley was dead at this point, were indignant about it. And Harry Jaffa was too, but for a very different reason. He called me up, he was 92 then, and he said, "So you wrote this article about Buckley and National Review all being segregationists. How come he didn't mention me?" He said, "I'm the first one who said it. I'm the one who said they were all followers of John C. Calhoun. Give me a little more credit in your piece."
Well, Calhoun was a big hero when I was in the Party of the Right. People were always quoting Calhoun on just about everything. And Yale at that point had a Calhoun College, which it's no longer that. But
yes, when I was at Yale, I was there just for a year at a graduate school. My professor, R.W.B. Lewis, the great biographer and literary scholar, was the master of Calhoun College, as I remember. All that language is quite amazing. It stayed with us as long as it did, isn't it?
Now it's Grace Hooper, and they're the head of the college, I think. No longer.
Right, 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 right. Yeah.
There was an article in Spy magazine by a former National Review intern that quoted extreme racism coming out of Jeffrey Hart, but also Buckley himself. Did you come across that article? I didn't see you reference it in the book.
I know that article very well, and it was one of the sources that just fell away. I should have cited it, though, in all my many notes. It's a fascinating article. And at the time, I think it was, yeah, it was published in 1989, I think. I asked Rick Burkheiser, who was at that point, when I was writing the book and began working the book in the 90s and early 2000s, he was kind of the reigning disciple at that point, left National Review. And he was very upset by that article. But I asked him, but is it true? And he said, well, you haven't heard anybody deny any of the facts in it, have you?
Oh, I bet they lawyered that one up pretty well.
Yeah, it was accurate.
That was the first part of an interview with Sam Tenenhaus, author of Buckley, The Life and Revolution That Changed America. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the Courant from Bach's Partita No. 1, performed by Rosalind Turek at William F. Buckley's Manhattan Maisonette, as it's amusingly dubbed, a 10-room duplex on East 73rd Street just off Park Avenue. And now part two of my interview with Sam Tenenhaus. Now, he had some interesting renegades, very talented people that he nurtured at National Review that then went on to either reject or even oppose the politics. So you mentioned Gary Wills, John Leonard, Arlene Croce, John Didion. What was his secret, and how did he manage to nurture such substantial talents?
He was a wonderful mentor, and so even someone, now we're dropping down many levels here, those are all great figures, but even somebody like me, you know, he thought I was a pretty good writer, and that was good enough, and he would help me along. And if you could write well, he was interested. You know, he had an artist's feel for language, and I'm a little disappointed. You know, this book has gotten, a lot of ink has been spilled on it, and I'm a little disappointed that there hasn't been more genuine curiosity expressed or admiration for Buckley, the literary man. Not that he was a great writer, he was a very good one, but his presence in the literary world was really large. Great friends with Norman Mailer and Ken Galbraith and Truman Capote. And there's you're asking about these figures. There's a great remark that Buckley's colleague William Rusher made. He was the longtime publisher of National Review, and he said to me, and I think to others as well, he said, well, it's a good thing the Communist Manifesto wasn't better written or we would have lost Buckley.
That actually was pretty well written.
It was pretty well written. And if Buckley had read, what is it, Chapter 8 in Das Kapital, which describes the working conditions for the children being exploited in British factories, which is a magnificent polemic, Buckley might have been brought around by him. And might have done him some good, but he liked talent. He was a friend of talent, and he liked interesting personalities. And he didn't find all that many conservatives as interesting as he found the liberals. Liberals had broader tastes. They were often worldlier. They liked good prose. But he seldom talked about politics with friends. He talked about what he read in the New Yorker. He would send notes to just bylined writers of the New York Times. If he liked a story they did, he'd just send them a letter.
As you say in the book, and you quote people saying this too, he was more of a publicist than a stylist and a thinker. He never managed to finish that big book he started, Was it a lack of attention? Was he just too busy being a celebrity? What held him back?
Yeah, those things certainly. Also, his mind didn't work that way. And I feel a little bad that some read the book and they think I'm faulting Buckley for not being a deeper philosophical thinker, or that I'm trying to undermine him by saying that. No, he was a different kind of intellectual. You can be an intellectual leader, as he was, without being one of the leading intellectuals of your time. But he didn't have the patience to do a lot of serious reading and thinking. His mind worked very quickly. He sped from one event to the next. Look, two of the best books he wrote, each of them covers one week in his life. That's what his life was like. He's speeding everywhere from the limousine to the office to the airplane to the hotel room and the green room. He's writing columns while he does this. He's on the phone. You know, he's got two telephone lines in his limousine. All this stuff is going on. He's having lunch and dinner with socialites. His wife was the most powerful social figure in Manhattan in the 1980s. Buckley's living this life constantly. He just doesn't have the temperament to shut himself up in a room and pore over books or documents and make that kind of argument. He was intellectually curious, but to get to the roots of things didn't interest him so much because he knew what he believed. He'd never questioned the values he'd inherited from this extraordinarily brilliant and dynamic father. And the role of the father's life on Bill can't be overstated, not just of his life, but of his personality and affect. And Bill Buckley wanted to do things. He was a doer. And, you know, Yeats says somewhere of Oscar Wilde, you know, he's this brilliant writer and great spinner of poetry and, of course, great dramas and such. But he said he was a man of action. And Buckley was. He was a man of action. He was a man of action with an amazing arsenal of words.
Speaking of Oscar Wilde, you write about this. There are whispers of Buckley being gay. His publisher, William Rusher, was his friend, Marvin Lehman. Closeted gays have a history on the right. Was he one of them?
I think he wasn't, although there are younger men who knew him who will say otherwise, not younger gay men, not because they had sexual encounters with him. I found no evidence. People would whisper about them to me, and no evidence turned up. Listen, though, we both know it doesn't really make any difference. The only reason the subject comes up is because the movement made so much of homophobia. That's what drove him and Marvin Liebman apart, was when Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority was fundraising during the AIDS crisis by attacking gay men.
Buckley himself wrote that appalling piece about tattooing men with AIDS.
Yes, he did. He wrote it in the New York Times, my old publication. And that, by the way, this idea that gay men should be tattooed on the buttocks, as Buckley wrote, on their asses, was one that had been kicking around. I had not realized that there had been polls taken. What should we do to stop the spread of the AIDS virus? And one of the suggestions was that men be tattooed. And the public overwhelmingly rejected it, even when the public was still largely homophobic. It just summoned up memories of Auschwitz. And one of Buckley's close friends, a gay man on the right, wrote to him and told him that, a Jewish man. He said, listen, this sounds a lot like what was going on in concentration camps. You're really going to brand people in this way? And Buckley said, well, I'm just trying to protect them. You know, I'm just trying to do what's best. He never questioned or challenged, you know, Pat Buchanan and Rush Limbaugh, Pat Robertson, these other figures on the right, who were expressly homophobic, wanted to build the movement, the new phase of the movement out of homophobia.
That goes back to the subject of him having to make alliances with some really distasteful people to promote his politics, which were not automatically popular.
No. I do not pretend to have gotten to the bottom of it.
When he started National Review, that famous, our statement of purpose, I think they call it, talks about standing athwart history and saying stop. They're very much an oppositional force. And it's interesting that he saw that the arena was more cultural than material. I mean, he's not so much interested in the power or the money. He was much more interested in the cultural elite, which he thought were captured by liberals and fighting them. But 40-some years later, they're on top of the world. The Republican Party is pretty much I wouldn't say lineal descendants, because I want to get to this in a moment, but you know, they are rather different in style from what he was all about. But how did he deal with that, starting out in opposition and ending up being a part of the dominant culture?
First of all, I want to ask you something, Doug. Don't you think that was quite brilliantly prescient of him to see that it was going to be a culture war? I mean, the term didn't even exist back then, because you know something about the movement. Or is your perception, when you were a very young guy and got interested in it, did it seem to you like it was as much a cultural as a political protest movement?
Well, when I was on the right, I was a libertarian. The two books that pushed me to the right, I have to say, made me a teenage reactionary. One was Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom, and the other was Up From Liberalism, Buckley's Up From Liberalism.
So interesting. Okay.
The Friedman angle did influence me, but you know, I could see a lot of the people in the Party of the Right were very much about the culture war. There are also some monarchists in the Party of the Right, too, but you know, the right has many different sides.
Well, we've got monarchists now on the right, don't we?
Yeah, we've got Curtis Yarvin, yeah.
Curtis Yarvin, yeah.
His hero, Charles I, was also the hero of the Party of the Right.
Well, it's very interesting, too, because Up From Liberalism, which is not a tremendous success as a book, where it's best, of course, is in its dismantling of liberal orthodoxies. That was always Buckley's great subject. He was always best on the attack. And as you say, in that famous statement of purpose, that mission statement in the first issue of National Review, written by Buckley himself, he wants to explain why it is he thinks the nation needs a conservative magazine to make the case at the very moment when a Republican president, a very popular one, is finally in the White House. You know, the first time since Herbert Hoover. The Democrats won 5 elections in a row. It boggles the mind. But they won every election held in the 1930s and 40s.
But the right hated Ike.
Hated him. Well, because he was the sellout. You know, I've gotten very interested in the Black Power movement for my next book. And it's interesting to see the critiques of the integrationists like Martin King that came from Malcolm X and the Black Panthers. That they're the sellouts, you know. They're the ones who want to shine the shoes of the white guys and maybe get a few crumbs tossed their way. And that's kind of how Buckley and company saw Eisenhower. Eisenhower was actually quite conservative in many ways, but he also was a pragmatist and saw the New Deal was not going to get rolled back. Whitaker Chambers tried to tell Buckley that. Now tell him in those famous letters, you can't do it. You can't go to the farmers who were Chambers' neighbors in Maryland. He was a farmer too in the late 50s and tell him, no, you don't want those government subsidies for your crops. They say, are you kidding me? Of course we need them, just the way the farmers need them now. And Trump knows they do. When Buckley talked about the New Deal, I was really struck by this. He didn't say New Deal programs. He would say things like the New Deal vision or the Roosevelt vision of society. See, then he's talking about attitudes that are as much cultural as they are economic or ideological.
I'm speaking with Sam Tannenhaus, author of Buckley, The Life and Revolution That Changed America, just out from Random House. And when he ran for mayor in 1965, mayor of New York City, he really brought forward the possibility of white resentment as a political force. And I think you say, you know, they liked some government programs, but, you know, don't do anything to raise black people was pretty much that message. And you know, that's a problem that the conservative movement has even today. Like cutting Medicare, Medicaid would really damage the constituencies of the MAGA movement. This is a problem that they never to this date have solved.
It's curious because at least rhetorically, they get it. That is Trump and Vance and Josh Hawley and others will say, well, we can't rip away the safety net. We have to have child tax credits for middle class, working class people. They say all these things. Then they seldom enact the policies. And the mystery, the marvel of it is they hold on to their constituents anyway. And I would guess, I mean, I think we kind of know it's for these cultural reasons. That's where the connection is. And who was it? Tom Frank, who wrote the book all those years ago, What's the Matter with Kansas? I really made that argument that, you find the place where you can forge an alliance, again, over the people and things and words you don't like. I think how successful the attack on the universities, initiated by Bill Buckley in that first and still most important book, God and Man at Yale, his very first book. He was a kid when he wrote it. It's still, I think, the most important book to come out of the right. It set the table, set the stakes. We're going to go after the Ivy League. We're going to go after the intellectuals, go after the Mandarins, go after those who seem to dictate what's respectable in the culture, the idioms and vocabularies we use. Chris Rufo, Barry Weiss, they're doing the same thing now. They're not doing it with Buckley style and humor, that flashing wit that he had. They're entrepreneurs the way he was. And they're carrying on the campaign he initiated. And it was, just a stroke of genius on his part that he saw it. And it was, as you said, because he was inside that world himself. That was the news in God and Man at Yale. People have been attacking the Ivy League from the beginning. The House Committee on American Activities, HUAC as we call it, red-hunting legislators. They were always going after Harvard and saying it was a hotbed of communists. What made Buckley different was first he chose Yale, which was one of the most conservative of the Ivy League institutions. More important still, he was the big man on campus. He was the last man tapped for Skull and Bones, the number one social trophy of his time. Buckley won it. He was the editor of the newspaper. He was handsome and popular. And here he is denouncing his professors. And so there was a kind of sensationalistic aspect to it. And that became key to how the movement developed in the next years. And he did the same thing in National Review. He calls them out by name. We're going after you, Arthur Schlesinger and James Wexler, who was the editor of the New York Post, a liberal publication. Denounce them by names, go after them, ridicule them, mock them. The same thing we see in Breitbart or Fox or now social media. It's the same thing. It's the same strategy. It's enormously successful in part because liberals are not always super candid about where they really stand. That was the success of God and Man at Yale. It wasn't that Bill Buckley was accusing them of being communists, which he wasn't, by the way. He was accusing them of being Keynesians, even worse in some way in his mind, and of being atheists. Yeah, he accused them of those things. But where the punch got delivered, the wall of game, when he said, why don't they just come out and admit it? Why don't they send letters out to alumni and donors saying Yale's a Christian university when it isn't any longer? And so critics on the right, like Dwight MacDonald and Izzy Stone, I.F. Stone, they liked that Buckley did that. They praised him for it because he was calling them out. He was calling out the liberal establishment, a term National Review coined, by the way, in the 1950s, in the same way that a Mamdani or an AOC is calling out the Democratic establishment today, saying, where do you stand?
This leads to my final question. This is a very different conservative movement today. I mean, we've got these tech and private equity plutocrats allied with vulgarians like Trump, and then bigots like Nick Fuentes and lunatics like Laura Loomer. I don't think Buckley would have approved of Chris Rufo's wanting to take down one of the Ivies, as I think Rufo has said. So, you know, looking at this metamorphosis over time, first, what do you think he would think of it? And second of all, is that kind of low-rent bigotry and ignorance, which characterizes so much of today's right wing, is that a betrayal of what Buckley founded or a realization of something that was always there?
I would say it's probably a realization of the worst aspect, which he did try to purge the movement of. It took him a while.
Except for McCarthy.
Except for McCarthy, insisted McCarthy was a good man, partly because he thought McCarthy was being ganged up on. So he felt that he was kind of he was taking the side of the underdog there, or an odd thing. But also, he never doubted. Buckley was perfectly at home with the Ivy League qua Ivy League. He wanted to take it back to its roots, and he thought it could still happen.
Although it wouldn't have liked the Catholics so much. I mean, the early Yale would not have liked the Catholicism.
His own Yale didn't like it. There was a quota, 13% Catholics. He was surprised to discover when he was working on his book, he found out that there was the same limitation on Catholics as there was on Jews. Black students you could count on two hands, really, in all of the Yale of Buckley's time. But he's a private institution. They're allowed to admit or not admit anyone they like.
And now we have Trump stepping on that. Trump wants to control the admission.
Yes, we do. Yeah, you know, Buckley warned that was going to happen, too. In 1959 or 60, when the government began giving a lot of money to research universities to catch up with the Soviets after the Sputnik launch, 1957, there was something called, I think, the National Defense Education Act under Eisenhower. It's going to give hundreds of millions of dollars, they're tantamount today to billions, or the equivalent of billions, to research universities to try to develop weapons. And the faculty and administrators were supposed to sign loyalty oaths, and some of them wouldn't do it and rejected the money. And Buckley said, good for you. He said, what's not so good is if you take the money and won't sign the loyalty oath, because then you want it both ways. And he wrote this, Doug, and I think it was like 1960. He said, I predict now that the government is going to come after Harvard and demand to see their application and admissions data. He nailed it. He got it. He didn't know it was going to be Trump doing it from the right, but he got it. He got that they were pushing too far, and the universities were allowing it to happen. So there, then you get it again. You get what seems to be the hypocrisy or the unacknowledged ideology of the liberals, is they say one thing and they do something that's a little bit different. Not to say conservatives don't do this all the time, but it's always a weak point that you can attack. And Buckley did it with extreme skill and precision, probably the best ever. No one was better at catching you out in the contradictions of your arguments. Maybe that's one reason he couldn't write a serious philosophical work himself, is that he was too conscious of where the arguments broke down.
You have that brutal quote from Kevin Phillips. There was, of course, a time when Bill Buckley was anti-establishment, back in the long-ago days when he's an Irish nouveau riche cheerleader for Joe McCarthy. But since then, he's primed his magazine with cast-off Habsburg royalty, Englishmen who part their names in the middle, and others calculated to put real lace on Buckley's Celtic curtains. In all deference to Squire Willie, he has done very well. Harsh, but it does capture something about the trajectory of his career.
Kevin Phillips, who was, I think, kind of a genius, and whom Buckley first sponsored, by the way, publishing the first book. It was his publishing company that brought out The Emerging Republican Majority, which is, what, one of the handful of really most incisive books written on modern American politics, along with Gary Wills' Nixon Agonistes. Phillips saw where the movement was going, that it was becoming more overtly populist. And maybe this is where we're getting a little closer to this first question you began with, Doug, which is, how do you take this patrician like Buckley, or at least someone who has a patrician set of ideas and affects, and combine them with the unwashed mob, as they thought of it? And then it's always an uneasy alliance, but there's the consciousness always that Buckley himself is aloof from it. Phillips is coming along and saying, really, we don't need you anymore. You know, I think I call it, picked up a phrase from Paul Weyrich, the blue bloods versus the blue collars.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, they don't need the blue bloods anymore. Reagan saw that with Buckley. Reagan got to the point, once he was elected in 1980, he knew where the support was coming from. He did not need Bill Buckley the way Richard Nixon had needed Buckley. He needed Buckley to keep the Birchers, as Nixon continued to call them. I find that really amusing, because he'd been stung by them when he lost the race for governor in California in 1962. The John Birch Society members, who were, you know, real zealots, didn't like Nixon. They didn't think he was anti-communist enough.
My first presidential vote was for John Ashbrook, because I thought Nixon wasn't conservative. He'd imposed wage and price controls, which is one of the things I recall finding an outrage.
Oh, the 1972 Republican primary.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. John Ashbrook, yeah. Right? Yeah, and it was Bill Rusher, Buckley's colleague at National Review, who put Ashbrook up to that. And some others. Buckley initially supported Ashbrook. In fact, you can go on YouTube and see the ad Buckley cut for Ashbrook in that primary, New Hampshire primary. Of course, what turned Buckley off was the overture to China. He never got that. And he told me not long before he died, I saw Buckley 3 weeks before he died. And then when I left his house, I realized I was never going to see him again. And he was just doing his last round of conversations with people. And he said Henry Kissinger had come over to see him. This is Buckley's house in Stamford, and Kissinger had a place in Kent, Connecticut, which is close to where Buckley was raised in Sharon. And he said, and Henry, as I always called him, we're discussing Nixon's opening of China. And Kissinger said it really was Nixon's idea, because the right like to think that Kissinger was a Svengali who pushed Nixon into it. Kissinger said, oh, it was Nixon's idea. Nixon was right. He said, of course you have to do that. You don't shut out a nation of, at that point, 800 million people, and now about three times that many. You have to include them in geopolitics. You want the superpowers to, you know, negotiate and triangulate and all these things. And Buckley was still amazed by it. He said, well, I guess Henry and Nixon were right. He said it all these years later. Buckley, the anti-communist, deserves his props, though, I must say. I mean, he was an early and fervent admirer and champion of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He understood the dissidents behind the Iron Curtain. He's a hero to them to this day. You know, the great novelist Gary Steingart, I don't know if you're familiar with him, he's got a new novel out. And I saw him at a book event the other day. And he's the son of Russian emigres. And he said, I have to tell you, as Jewish emigres, you know, refuseniks who left Russia during the time of the Soviet Union when Jews were being persecuted. And Gary Steingart, very much a liberal, said to me, I have to tell you, he said, in my household, Bill Buckley was a hero. He was a hero because he spoke the truth about the Soviet Union. And that's true for many people of that generation.
That was Sam Tannenhaus, author of Buckley, The Life and Revolution That Changed America, just out from Random House. I suppose closing on an anti-communist note is appropriate to Buckley's political thought. It may have made him a hero to former Behind the News guest Gary Steingart and his family, but it's also what drove him into an alliance with the odious Joe McCarthy. Along those lines, we never did resolve the relationship between the highbrow Buckley and his lowbrow heirs. I suppose Sam Tannenhaus is right to see Trumpism as an evolutionary product of the worst of Buckley and his crew, but that worst was always there. The highfalutin stuff made him clubbable, but the odious stuff was never far from the surface. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more of Rosalind Turek playing Bach in the Buckley crib. This is Gide from his Partita No. 6. Till next week, bye.